Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and humor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking people from America coast to coast. Tonight, featuring commentary by T.O. Hardiman and Ray Hanania, and T.O. Hardiman and Brian Castle. Also, commentary from economist Mike Miller. And here we are, folks, at the Beyond the Beltway. Welcome all of you to the show and everything. So, you know, here we are. Just want to let everybody know that, again, my name is Bruno Behrend. I'm not Bruce Dumont. You might notice a slight difference in looks. And I've been a guest on this show quite a bit. And Bruce actually gave me a call, and he said, you know, I got to be out of town. He's actually going to visit family on a for a blessed event, which is going to be taking place soon. And it was a good idea for him to get out of town to do that. So he gave me a call and he said, hey, you want to guest host the show tonight? And at that point in time, I said, absolutely, I'd love to. So after I completely butcher his show and make all kinds of mistakes and everything else like that, hopefully things will work out. But it's actually a little bit strange for me to be here on the guests, on the host side of things when I have been a guest. But we're going to go with a lot of different discussion of all the different things that are happening today. So let's start with everything that's going on in America right now. The Trump transition continues. We've got some phone calls to Taiwan. We've got General Mattis now looks firmly ensconced. We also had the big Ohio rally, which we're going to talk about a little bit. So we'll start right away with you, T.O. Anything that you can think of along the lines of the Taiwan call? You know, should presidents be doing stuff like that, or president-elects?
Yeah, my commentary as it relates to Mr. Donald Trump, our president-elect, reaching out to Taiwan, kind of disrespecting the protocol that was in place. I don't think that's a good sign so far. We definitely had to give Donald Trump a chance to be a good president, but you can't start out. That's not a good way to start things off, disrespecting what's in place, so to speak, because that goes to show you that Trump is doing whatever he wants to do. Sometimes I look at Donald Trump, he appears to be very cocky. Mm-hmm. And we have to kind of be a little more humble when we serve as the president of the United States and think things a little more thoroughly through.
It makes sense. It's kind of tricky to be humble when you've just been president-elect. You know, if I were Barack Obama and I just won in 2008, I don't know how humble I'd be. I don't know if Donald Trump has much humility. Mike Miller, your thoughts?
Yes, he did violate protocol, and one I was always a. I'm glad that Hillary Clinton is not president, but I was not a supporter of Mr. Trump, although I'm enjoying watching this very much, and this is another example of that. Not that long ago, the president, Obama, went to China, and they dissed him where his plane came up. They didn't bring the stairs up and so forth. Yes. Instead of meeting them the way they're supposed to, they just couldn't be bothered to do it right. And it's my understanding that the call came from Taiwan to Mr. Trump, not the other way around. He didn't call them. And he could have done what everyone has done before, and that's to reject the call. But mm-hmm. he says, why not call? 10 minutes. They just want to talk to me. And there's something a little refreshing about it. As much as it is a violation of protocol, it certainly is not in keeping with the one China policy that we have. It sure is sweet to see some difference there. I'm not so sure this is necessarily a bad thing.
So, and for our guests, the one China policy, I mean, this is a non- written policy. It's not a law or anything, but it's just something that has been in place since Jimmy Carter basically recognized communist China as the speaker, the Chinese country, even though Taiwan has been a separate nation and has quite a bit of economic and cultural success on its own. So here Jimmy Carter did that. So Brian, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I did, you know, Theo said he did clearly violate some sense of protocol, but I would say it is a little refreshing to see someone think a little differently. Mm-hmm. And so he takes a call. He has a nice call. It didn't mean he changed policy. So I think we're all going to have to get used to a little bit different experience from this president because mm-hmm. he's not ever really been a politician. He's been a businessman and a politician to the extent that he was sucking up to politicians all throughout the country to get things done for his business, but he hasn't really been serving the people. He was serving his companies, right? So we've got just a little different animal here as president, and I think it's not all necessarily bad.
It's clearly there's a lot of different changes. I think people are going to be expecting a lot of – let's put it this way. They're going to be expecting the unexpected. So, Ray, do you think there's anything behind this? Is there any like policy shift? I mean, we're looking at Trump. We're looking at the things that he's done. A few days later, it always comes out that there's something behind what he's doing. It sounds like he's just ad-libbing at first, but then there's something going on behind it. Do you think there's anything specific about this breach of protocol, so to speak?
I think it reflects what he saw in the electorate. He connected with a lot mainstream America that wants change, that wants, you know, we're tired of, you know, all these little backroom deals. We're tired of these relationships. Tired of being hypocrites. I mean, China... I mean, when we really think about it, okay, Jimmy Carter opened the door to China, but I think it was dumb. I don't like China. I don't like what China is doing to our economy. I think if you talk to average people, they're going to be upset with China. So I think that this guy is doing what that mentality reflects. Why not talk to the president of Taiwan? Why not take the call from him? Why not accept congratulations from him? Where was the premier of China? Did the premier of China call Trump and congratulate him? I don't know. Did he?
I didn't hear anything.
Haven't heard.
So, Tio, yes. going back to that, is there any danger here? I mean, China, for those who have been critical of the Obama administration, China is one of the areas they've been critical of. They dissed him. They seem to be acting as if the United States is the fading, weakening superpower. They're feeling their oats. They have a billion people. Their economy is growing, despite the fact they're having some problems. I mean, is Trump sending any kind of a message here that you can think of? I mean, anything positive or dangerous or anything you can say about that?
Yeah, I think Trump is sending a message that he's going to be straightforward. He's going to do whatever he feels like doing. And I'm not anti-Trump. I want to make that clear. But let's look at world history just for a glance here. The Chinese invented the crossbow, okay? I'm talking about back in the ancient times. They invented gunpowder. The Chinese are very strong right now. We cannot take them for granted. They're a superpower, a world power, and the last thing we need is for Trump to lead this country into a war with China that's in the making, because there's something else behind a lot of these decisions that are being made. And China's steady watching. You know, you got the Russians, they're watching. Trump has a good relationship with Putin over in Russia, but that can change overnight. We have to be very careful now, in my opinion, when you talk about world leaders and world issues, because the United States, we're standing on some pretty strong ground right now, but we cannot afford to make mistakes based on Trump miscalculating his decisions.
Yeah, clearly China's a world player, but I'm convinced they need us more than we need them. The one thing we need them for is to keep buying our bonds when we go into debt, with the federal debt and so forth. But in terms of exports, for example, China is a tiny player in U.S. exports. We are a massive player for their exports. Were we to stop buying some of their exports, they would hurt dramatically. China is sitting on a currency and a banking loan situation, which is a time bomb, just ready to explode. If all of a sudden these firms can't pay back these loans and it all comes due, and there could be inflation, there could be a collapse of the Chinese economy. So I know that China is a world power in the same way, in some sense, that the Soviet Union was. Only reason they were a world power is because they had nukes.
So
they were a third world backwater when it came to being an economy.
When we come back, we'll actually go to the rest of our guests and ask them what they think. I mean, whether there's a danger here or what's going to be happening. Is there something that possibly go too far, or could China implode, or are we in danger of actually creating or starting a war? Back right after this.
Okay. Good stuff.
Coco and Joe, Susie Snowflake, Frosty the Snowman, and now Peter Cottontail have been digitally remastered by the Museum of Broadcast Communications. To own your digitally remastered DVD, go to museum.tv. All proceeds benefit the museum.
My name is Johnny Carson. My job is to make you laugh.
Johnny Carson brings you TV legends and classic moments every night on Antenna TV.
Don't make fun of me, Johnny.
And now through October, don't miss Here's Johnny, the making of The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. It's a must-see collection of Johnny's stage props, costumes, video, and more. For more info and tickets, go to museum.tv.
Welcome back to Beyond the Beltway. If you're just joining us, looking at the show, and you're like, that guy doesn't look like Bruce Dumont. My name is Bruno Barron. I'm sitting in for Bruce tonight. And tonight our program is coming to you from the base of the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. I'm getting all those numbers mixed up at this moment, but we got a call from Mike at KXLY in Spokane, Washington, asking his question for the night. Mike, go ahead. You're on.
Well, thank you, and Merry Christmas to everyone. Thanks for taking my call. You know, first of all, Trump will increase military programs, which is needed. He talked to the president of Taiwan, which is good, and he realizes communist China is a growing military threat monthly. But my question is, during this Christmas season, too, what is Trump's plans to help the poor and homeless in America now, which is growing daily?
Ray, you were a Trump fan from the beginning or from the middle somewhere. What do you think?
Whenever there's a bad economic time, a lot of people turn toward boosting up the military as a way to create immediate jobs. And, you know, you look at a lot of his cabinet appointees, a lot of them are billionaires, very successful business people. I don't know if we're going to expect him to see him handing out turkeys, you know, between now and Christmas. But I do think that long term, one of his intents is to boost up our economy, and I think that's going to help poor.
So, Tio, you're a Democrat on the panel, looking at things like the homeless and homelessness and issues like that. What should Trump do, or what do you think he might do, or what would be your recommendation on that?
Well, one thing I like about President Donald Trump is that he wants to make America great again. So maybe he should appoint somebody to work directly with the poor and the homeless population out there and see what more could be done to kind of shift the poor and the homeless into a better place here in America. But you can start making America great again from the bottom up. You can make it great that way. So that's what I would suggest, that Trump has the right advisors talking to him and helping him understand that if you're going to make America the country you want it to be, that means we've got to help everybody.
So, Mike, you're the caller. We've got a mic on the panel today, too, so I have to make sure I'm talking to which mic I'm talking to. So anything you hear there that you're looking at, or do you have any suggestions? What are your thoughts? Mike. I guess Mike is not with us anymore for that. So, well, we'll go to Brian. Brian, your thoughts on that? I mean, it's a tough issue when you really think about it. You've got a lot of different stuff that has to be done. We are deep in debt. I think Trump is inheriting an economy that is not as bad as many of the Republican candidates were saying during the election, but it's not robust or, you know, humming along either, really. You're spending a lot of money on things like, homeless don't necessarily get the trillion-dollar highway jobs. How do you solve a seemingly intractable problem like that?
Well, I spent the whole week at the convention in Cleveland and spent a lot of time with all the different people who were involved in helping Trump make America great again. And one of the things they talked about is jobs, jobs, jobs. All the things we need to do to get jobs back in this country. Our corporate taxes are too high. Our personal taxes are too high. They're going to go through a series of moves right after the inauguration to start lowering taxes to get things happening again in this country. We get job growth back. You know, we had a really good jobs report, according to many economists, 178,000 new jobs created. But if you look at it, there's a fair number of things in there that aren't really great. A lot of part-timers. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's a lot slower than it should be. When you think of the Reagan era, when we had very strong job growth, 300,000 jobs a month, you know, our population's 29% larger now. It should be 400,000, but we're getting excited about 178,000 jobs. So Trump's going to find a way, I think, to increase jobs in America. And that's probably the best program for poor people and maybe even homeless people to get out of their situation.
Okay, so, Mike, you're the economist. Mm-hmm. Let me just play, you know, Democratic activist or Democratic question, question you from a Democratic perspective. Mm-hmm. Is it really that easy? I mean, are we just going to be able to rerun the 1980s and cut taxes and America will be great again or things like that? There's a lot of structural changes that have taken place
in
jobs
correct.
As well.
One thing, when Ronald Reagan cut taxes, they went from 70 to 28. We're not talking about anything like that. There's not much research to show that tweaking around the edges the way we are is going to have any major effect upon growth. But when you look at the poor and the homeless, a lot of times I think people don't aren't willing to ask the question, in trying to help those who are poor and homeless, why are they poor and homeless? If it has to do with mental illness, there's not much that the president can do. That has to be done at the state or the local level. If the reason they're homeless is because they're alcoholics, maybe there's nothing at all the president can do. Maybe it's the state and local that have to get them off of the drugs or off the alcohol. If, in fact, the reason they're homeless or poor is because they just run into some bad luck, that's where the job creation comes in. And I think the amount that a president can do when it comes to poverty is quite limited. There's always going to be a group of people. When you have 330 million Americans, there's going to be a bunch of people who make terrible life decisions in terms of alcohol, in terms of drugs, in terms of education. And how are we supposed to have jobs for people who drop out of high school? I mean, we should make it as possible as we can that students can be retrained or people can be retrained to be welders or whatever it is that we need. But I think this idea that the president, that somehow magically the president can take care of poverty is just a ludicrous idea. Understand that once we had the war on poverty, we got it down from like 30% down to 14%. And we've been at 14% of the population being below the poverty line since 1970. All the trillions of dollars which have been spent, there's certain things we can and certain things we simply cannot do.
Well, and also, so Teos, you're the Democrat. Structurally, it's very difficult to do some of this stuff when, for example, everybody's talking about Trump bringing jobs back and things like that, when in fact you've got the situation where automation has taken more manufacturing jobs away than trade has.
Right.
And so you've got these issues with building the economy where you can help some of these people. And I think Mike mentioning the homeless along with people who have all kinds of intractable personal problems as well. Any suggestion that you have there?
Well, I think it was a great idea that you brought up as far as the concept of people with mental health illness, people that have other decisions they made in their lives that messed their lives up. We have to kind of categorize everything a certain way and look at how we can help people, because people with mental health issues really need a lot of help, okay? Mm-hmm. And right in Illinois right now, a lot of the mental health facilities have been closed because of the governor and some of the things that the current mayor has done in Chicago. So Trump is in a great position to definitely do a lot of good work on all levels of society. It's just that people have to give him a chance to do everything that he has planned to do. Now, one good thing about it, by him being a businessman, he's looking at it from a business perspective. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I don't want to see where he would step on the poor people and the working, you know, the poor people and the people with mental health illness. That would be really bad if they get stepped on.
Funding cuts or something along those lines. Yes. So we've got another call here from Jeannie in Austin on KLBJ. Jeannie, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you guys for giving the people a voice. I mean, obviously, you turn on television, and guess what? It's all pundits, all talking, disagreeing with one another. Nobody gets it right. I just want to make a statement, and I want to say that, you know, I hear Trump's campaign managers and everybody, you know, saying, get over it. Trump has won. Guess my attitude. My attitude and my opinion of it is you get over the fact that he didn't win the popular vote. And, you know, I feel he's personally a misogynistic person. You know, I called in before the election and said, I'm an incest survivor. I had big issues with all the accusations in the past of Bill, et cetera, and then Trump. And I felt like for a second there, women's, you know, attacks were a little bit on the radar, but then it fell back down again. And now we've got a president who said all these nasty things. I'm telling you, radio hosts and the world, as far as like CNN, all those people, don't tell people like me how to feel. He'll never be my president. I'll never accept him as my president. I think it's disgusting. And if he really cared about the people, why is he tweeting us up a storm about this and that?
Okay,
Go to Oakland, where the people have lost, you know, family and all that. He's not. Let's. You know, I don't get it. You got in. I voted Democrat. My husband voted for Trump. And you know what? Nancy Pelosi, they voted her back in, and Harry Reid,
so
they keep blaming everybody.
You have, so, Jeannie, you've got a lot of stuff there that you're, You've got a lot of stuff there that you're saying, and I think we understand your frustration. I think you're probably correct that if Trump had lost, there'd be a lot of frustration on the other side. Ray, I mean, there's a you've been a Trump supporter. There's a very, very heartfelt. You've also been very, very critical of Republicans, past Republicans, and you know the Jeb Bush Republicans and those kind of folks. What do you have to soothe the fevered brow of Jeannie?
Nothing. I just get used to it. I'll tell you what, the past 8 years, I like Barack Obama. I knew him. He was a good person. But it's so ironic that one of the first calls we get is about what do we do about the poor when we had a president who was from the south side of Chicago in national office. He really could have done something about that issue. We talk about jobs. I don't trust the numbers. I don't believe them. We have 95 million people that were taken out of the employment rolls, double what has been in the past, and nobody wants to explain how that impacts how we look at how many unemployed really – they're no longer considered unemployed, so maybe those numbers are really higher than we think. I'd really like to know what the real numbers are. Mm-hmm. I'm not – listen, I respect the caller. I don't care whether she is upset or accepting or not. The voters spoke. I'm going to give Trump a chance. I don't agree with him 100%. Mm-hmm. I'm basically a Democrat, but I think that he's going to bring the kind of change that we want. And even Democrats have been upset with the system over the last 8 years.
You know, something else I know, she said that Mr. Trump will never be her president, which is fine if that's what she wants to believe. A lot of people, when Mr. Obama was chosen, because of his policies, weren't a big fan. Ray, you're kind of hinting at that. But you know what those people were called? They were called racist. And if they had not accepted Hillary Clinton, they would be called misogynist or sexist.
Right.
Is there some name that we're going to call people that won't accept that Trump won the Electoral College? We don't run it by the popular vote.
Angry Democrats, perhaps,
or
things like that. So when we come back, we'll actually come back to some of these issues, as well as a question I have for the economists in the room.
If you look hard enough, go off the beaten track far enough, you'll find an America teeming with the unusual, the odd, the downright strange.
I'm Will Klinger, and I'm your guide on a package tour we like to call
Wild Travels.
Join me for a new season of Wild Travels, Sundays at 10:30 p.m. on WTTW Channel 11.
Is Chicago's perfect place for senior citizens. Enjoy a stroll down memory lane. Reminisce as museum artifacts, photos, and classic TV shows trigger recollections from your childhood. Enjoy the TLC you'll receive from our expert tour guides. Discounts for groups of 20 or more. Schedule yours right now at museum.tv or call 312-245-8200. Plan your fun trip now at the Museum of Broadcast Communications.
Welcome back to Beyond the Beltway. And if you haven't noticed, I'm not Bruce Dumont. Bruce Dumont actually took the weekend off to go to Palm Springs, and I think he's got a blessed event in his family that's occurring. And God bless Bruce for being able to go and do that, and lucky him, not only for that event, but also Palm Springs, which here in Chicago, everybody, we've had, five or six inches of snow today.
We've
got some people from Chicago texting all of you around the rest of the country all the nice pictures of the snow that we're having here. So our program tonight, again, is coming to you from our base in Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, and our toll-free lines are open, 1-800-723-8289, if you'd like to get into this. But I'm going to let the guests also introduce themselves here, tell them a little about themselves. Tio Hardiman, you're... From?
Yeah. Well, Tio Hardiman from Chicago, Illinois. You know, I ran for governor back in 2014, and we secured close to 30% of the state vote, winning 30 counties downstate. So I'm really considering doing something else in politics soon, but I won't talk about it on the show today. But I also serve as an adjunct professor at Governor State University, teaching in the field of criminal justice, and I'm doing everything I can do with my organization, Violence Interrupters Incorporated, to help try to change mindsets and behaviors associated with violent thinking to help, you know, with a public health approach to try to help reduce violence in Chicago, which is kind of tough right now.
And those of our listeners who are following things that are going on here in Chicago know that that's a very, very important thing to be working on. We also have Ray Hanania. Ray, you have a similar background to mine in the past, having had a radio show.
I was a City Hall reporter for 20 years, including for the Sun-Times, and I launched my own media company. I have about a handful of clients that I do political consulting for. But I've never left writing. I still write a column every week for seven newspapers, the regional news, the reporter, Southwest News Herald, Des Plaines Valley News. And I write for a lot of publications in the Middle East, like the Arab News in Saudi Arabia.
So are you our Middle East expert here tonight?
I'm probably one of the only Arabs that hasn't been arrested, and I'm not on the FBI's watch list. So I'm free to come on and speak my mind without worrying about being incarcerated.
Yes. Excellent. And then we also have a first-time guest on the show. This
ring
is the
first bell,
time
right?
Ring, yeah. Do we have a bell to ring or something like that?
Ring the bell.
So right. Brian Castle, tell us about yourself.
Sure. So I'm a longtime financial advisor. I work for various firms, Payne Weber, Lehman Brothers, firms that don't exist anymore. I was a partner at William Blair & Company in Chicago and spent some time at Morgan Stanley. And a few years ago, founded my own firm, Four Star Wealth Advisors, right here in Chicago. So we want to make sure the Illinois business community is good here as an entrepreneur and a new CEO of a firm.
All right.
I'm very involved in politics just as a volunteer. Like I said, I went to the convention. Been a donor to the Republican National Committee and very involved in local politics as well.
Were you a delegate?
I wasn't a delegate. I was just a member of the Eagles program for the RNC, and I'm a former ward committeeman. I was also co-chair for volunteers for the Bush campaign for Bush-Cheney 2000.
Okay.
We didn't win that campaign here, but somebody had to do the work, right?
And so they didn't. I guess they didn't win the popular vote that year either.
That year either. That's right.
Presidency.
That's right.
Mike Miller.
Yeah, Mike Miller. I'm an economist at DePaul University. I got my PhD in University of Pittsburgh and moved here and have had one job in my adult lifehood. I teach macroeconomics, mainly to MBAs. And I do my research about the country of Bahrain, the economy and how it operates and doesn't and so forth. So, and also, being an unusual person at DePaul, I'm a Republican. There aren't that many Republican conservatives in academia, so I get to be the mentor for the college Republicans and
are there
young
Republicans
Americans
in Illinois?
There are
yeah,
some.
Say,
are
they? And I'm shocked that they haven't chased you out of DePaul yet.
They haven't.
There's a few of us.
The loveliness of tenure.
Yes. So really quickly, folks, for those of you who don't know, I'm Bruno Behrend. I've been a guest on this show for quite a few times, and I really appreciate the fact that Bruce has had me on and also tapped me for filling in this time. My background is I'm generally a political activist who's been around for quite a while. I've done some advising to campaigns from a policy perspective, another gentleman who ran on the Republican side for governor a few years ago, as well as some other campaign consulting, also relatively well-known as a senior fellow at the Heartland Institute, primarily focusing on education issues. So that's our background here tonight. We're all having a good time talking about the things that are going on in the country. But, Mike, the question I had for you as an economist, and we've kind of been on the show here, we're talking about $1 trillion of infrastructure funding. We've talked about how to get homeless or how to get, you know, fix homeless problems or things like that, get people back to work. We're talking about defense spending. I saw an article today about the bring back the F-22 Raptor because the F-35 isn't working. And there's all these people that are now coming to Washington hat in hand saying, spend on my big program. All at a time when we're, $20 trillion in debt.
$20 trillion.
And that's not including the off-the-books debt of the unfunded liabilities. Mm-hmm. So the question I've had for you, and any other economist or business person, anybody who wants to chime in on this, is how can we spend all this stuff that we say we need to spend with a $20 trillion debt? And then why have we been doing this and there's been no inflation? Why has all of this stuff – I mean, it was predicted that Obama would destroy the economy. Mm-hmm. We've had the slowest recovery ever. It's
yes.
just almost 8 years in, starting to get started a little bit with 3% growth. But how can we pay for all of this while at the same time giving tax cuts?
We can't. It's all a matter of priorities, where you're going to put your money. Now, if the government is going to do things like provide roads, the roads have to be kept up. Now, a lot of people think that infrastructure will lead to all these increases in productivity. Well, understand that we already have the only increase in productivity will be the marginal benefit you get from the road being better than it would have been otherwise. But we don't – the problem is if you only have so many dollars and you have to spend it on certain things, then you have to give and take. And the problem we've built into the budget is that there are so few things that can take. In other words, almost huge parts of the budget are Social Security and so forth, things that we simply are non-negotiable, which leaves a very tiny fraction of the total budget of the government, which is manipulable. Mm-hmm. So maybe what we should do is we should take away all support for, say, opera, because who goes to opera anyhow, right, except rich white people. Mm-hmm. So you take away all the money for opera, and we're talking pittance of money. So there's just not any big places. And the big places that would help getting the budget under control are the ones we absolutely will not touch, including Mr. Trump. I was shocked that he never once brought up the idea of the problems that exist with Medicare and with Social Security, that Social Security is broke and that Medicare is a time bomb ready to go off. And it's just going to get worse and worse. And it's a demographic certainty. No one wants to deal with this particular issue. So I don't know how. And then if you do cut taxes, his whole thing is predicated on growth increasing. Now, I believe there could be some increase in growth. But would it be sufficient to generate the money to do all these things? And I just don't see it. So I don't know how they're going to pull it off.
So, Brian, you're a fan of Trump. You're thinking that he might be getting things rolling again. How's he going to do it, given that that bleak outlook from our economist on the panel?
Well, I wasn't originally a fan of Trump. I had some other candidates in the race. Out of 17, you can be sure that there were a lot of people who picked other candidates. But obviously, he's our president now, and I voted for him, and he was the candidate of the Republican Party. But I do think he has an opportunity to do a lot of very good things. One of the things I did talk about in the transition meetings that I was part of at the convention was it's really time to stop spending on a deficit basis. Think in terms of that $20 trillion as a big pile, and every year we take a few more shovels, another trillion, put it on top. We can't keep doing that. Obama's group has doubled the national debt in 1 8-year period of time. As much debt as all other presidents before him have put on. So we've got to stop that. And that'll kill our country if we can't stop that.
So, Ray, any from your experience, I mean, your experience in the Middle East, we've spent Trump just mentioned in his Ohio speech, $6 trillion in the Middle East in the last almost 16 years. Is there a place in your mind is a place to cut, or can the spending yield enough growth to pay for all of it?
I took the time and I read his book, Great America, and I went through it. He's very clear about defending Social Security. He was talking about how his vision was to stimulate the economy, to create jobs in this country that would then, with stimulated job growth, you'd be able to bring people up. That would address the needs of the poor. That would then bring in more money to support social programs like people that are disabled and mentally ill that need support like that. But it's a whole process. It isn't like one thing. You can't create a program to go in there and take the poor off the street. And I know the economy is better, but I drive in from Orland Park. I pass maybe 30 intersections. I'll see two or three people asking for money on street corners at these intersections, whereas a number of years ago, maybe I saw one or two. And you can't just take one problem and address it. You got to really look at the big macro, maybe the big picture, and I think that's what he's doing. And I'm hoping that's what he's going to do.
Tio, do you see that happening? I mean, is that really going to be able to be done when you consider all of the people that are now marching to Washington, hats in hand, saying that we have to redo our priorities, and you've got Donald Trump saying, I'm not touching Social Security or Medicare? How do you do it?
Well, I think what Donald Trump is going to do in particular, he's going to make a lot of his wealthy friends wealthier again as well. Okay, I want to make that clear. But quickly, if you don't mind me saying, a young lady called in about Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton's biggest mistake was trying to live off the legacy of Barack Obama. The country was looking for a new idea, a new person with a new vision. I think that was a critical error in judgment by the Clinton campaign. Okay. But going back to Donald Trump, he's not going to touch Social Security. That's a good thing because a lot of people are depending on Social Security later on down the road. I mean, generations to come. Oh, so he should definitely not touch Social Security.
No, but
if he decides to touch it, he should give the people their money that have invested in it over the years that have money in there, about working jobs.
Yeah, but that's not how it works.
I mean, I know that, but he should give them
people their money. The Supreme Court has made it clear that that money does not belong to us. There's no property right to Social Security. I'm 63. When I go to get it when I'm 67 or 70, whenever I ask for it, there's nothing that stops the government saying, well, I've changed my mind. You don't get it.
That'd be rough.
That's not true about my retirement because that's a property right.
So what we're going to have to do when we come back is we're going to have to solve all of the problems inside Social Security and how to fix it. And then we'll just wrap that up and send it to the Trump administration.
And he'll do nothing with it.
So stay tuned for that, folks. We'll be right back and do that for you.
The beauty of Amlink's interior landscape is that we can come in, work with your budget, and create a fit that makes sense for your facility at that time. Our goal is to create foliage designs that not only look incredible the day we put them in, but you can go back 2 years later and it is still maintained and has grown as a perfect fit for that customer's environment.
Call Amlinks now at 888-880-TREE.
A historic moment from the archives at museum.tv.
There can be no stable and enduring peace without the participation of the People's Republic of China and its 750 million people. That is why I have undertaken initiatives in several areas to open the door for more normal relations between our two countries.
Experience more history at museum.tv.
Welcome back to Beyond the Beltway. My name is Bruno Behrendt. If you haven't noticed, I'm sitting in for Bruce Dumont today. We've got a really great panel. Right before the break, we were talking about how we were going to solve the problems of the budget and fixing all of America's problems while we're $20 trillion in debt. We've got a caller from Austin, Joe from KLBJ, who says he's got a solution. Joe, go ahead.
Yeah, I think if you look at American history, the times that the country really, the economy boomed, it's when we had a great deal of legal immigration, you know, people pouring in mostly from Europe. So what Trump needs to do is, you know, to eliminate illegal immigration, but then to emphasize legal immigration, bring in a lot of entrepreneurs and, you know, people who have skills that we need. And, you know, I have my own brother-in-law came to this country. He immigrated here and built a spray booth for cars, a factory that makes spray booths, and he employs over 100 people now.
Well, and you're making a very, very important point regarding immigration, and you've got a lot of people who seem to think that if we just get rid of illegal immigration, there'll be more jobs for more people. I am a son of two post-war German immigrants that met here, and my dad came over here and made a life. Ray, yeah, your thoughts on the caller's idea?
Well, I don't think immigration is going to building a wall or stopping illegal immigrants from coming in, I don't think that's going to save our economy. I do think that is a security issue. It's an issue that has to do with dealing with today's world of violence from the Middle East, where my parents immigrated from, to get away from a lot of that. But, you know, I think that one of the ideas that I was going to throw out on the table was, you know, when I was growing up in the 60s, in the late 60s, I enlisted in the military. I ended up going to school on the GI Bill. I've had a job. It got me on my feet. You know, it ended up really kind of boosting me up. And I wonder if there's not some way to look toward the military and use it as a base, not to go around starting wars around the world, but to kind of use it as a base for an economy, to build up and create jobs for people that need it.
Looking at it through the eyes of as an academic economist, what we look for is there any empirical evidence that would associate legal immigration with stronger economic growth? And there is some, for example, that states which take more legal immigrants, you tend to grow faster than states that don't. But if you take the country as a whole, we find that immigrants are roughly slightly net positive. They don't add that much. They add new ideas, which is really great. The other thing is if what the caller is saying is interesting, and he says we need all these people to come in and start businesses and bring their skills and so forth. That's exactly what we don't do in our immigration policy. Since the 1960s, it has been family reunification and diversity. It has not been to look at those people that can do the most for the United States. Now, when Mr. Trump and others have pushed such a thing, where we would focus on, like many other countries do, to let people into the country who can do us some good, they are called all kinds of names, racist and homophobes, or they're called Islamophobes if we're trying to keep out certain people from the Muslim world? Or
to be fair on that, though, even though you're correct as they've changed the focus on that, you also see in the Mexican community in particular, which I think when we talk about immigration, that everybody's code word mostly talking about Mexicans, at least in the debate of illegal immigration. So, but, Tio, some of those people have become unbelievably successful entrepreneurs. They've started businesses. They've done things exactly like Joe has talked about.
What's important that people start businesses, that's what America is all about. But if you come over here illegally, you should not be allowed to really benefit in this country. I'm not against immigration or immigrants or whatever the case may be, because we all all of our roots are not from the United States when we get finished talking. A lot of us come from different countries.
Right.
But the reality is, if you come over here illegally, you should have to go back to your country and go through the process, because what we're doing, we're setting up a standard that it's okay to break the law. And that's wrong right there. I'm grateful for the success, as long as it has not hurt the country. But I understand what the caller's talking about, how Trump will stimulate the economy by legal immigration. I don't see the correlation, though. But that's my take on it.
Yeah, I don't either.
So, Brian, you're in the financial industry. You've looked at this from a lot of different perspectives, maybe kind of like high finance. But is Joe from Texas onto something here?
He could be. I mean, it's not really clear, as Mike said, that legal immigration necessarily causes growth. But I think the comments that you made, Tio, about illegal immigration, we need to find a way to solve those issues, right? Then we can go on further and see what kind of immigrants make us look good, what kind of immigrants will help us grow.
Yeah, you have to understand. One thing about it is, if you look at the economy growing well and you see lots of immigrants coming in, you assume that the immigrants have caused the growth. Maybe it's the other way around. Understand that immigration is a combination of push factors and pull factors, things that push you out of your country that pull you into another country. It could be that economic growth leads people to want to be in the U.S. because they know they can be successful. So the most important thing that the government can do is create the conditions necessary to create jobs. Mm-hmm. Mr. Trump cannot create jobs. He can only create the conditions where people like you and me and investors create jobs.
Right. But there's a difference in what motivated immigrants from my dad's generation and today's generation. My dad's generation, they weren't running in fear from tyranny and oppression. They lived in terrible places, but they came here because they thought, hey, I can come here, I could start a business, I could create a life, I could create a job. Today we have people running from Mexico because it's terrible over there. We have people from the Middle East wanting to come here because it's horrible over there. We got refugees coming from every place. These are people that didn't want to come here by choice in a lot of cases, but felt they had to come here just because they wanted to feel safe. That's a different motivation than my parents who wanted to start a job or who wanted to start a business.
Right. And I think what's important about all of this is you're looking at the motivation. Here you have the richest country in the world with the most powerful country. It's got all these jobs, all these different things going on, and it's bordering what was, up until a few years ago, a third world country. I think you can fairly say Mexico has grown tremendously and done very well in terms of now being, I think, the 11th largest economy in the world. They're almost hitting the top 10. Probably because of all the transfers back and forth between the United States.
Proximity.
So what we're going to do when we come back, and stay tuned, folks, because what we're going to have here is some news that's going to be coming up. But after that, we're going to throw it out to you, the listeners, and also the panel, as to ideas for Donald Trump to make the world a better place. It could be in any from across the spectrum. Throw in a left-wing idea, throw in a right-wing idea, but let's figure out how we're going to help Donald Trump become a good president. Back
Very
after
good.
This.
Okay.
Vacationing in Florida, so why not experience it as it was meant to be, where turquoise Gulf waters meet tranquil island beaches. Feel the powder soft sand between your toes. Revel in a glorious island sunset. Shop the boutiques of a seaside village. Ride horseback along tranquil waters. This is Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Real, authentic Florida, where you can discover an intimate downtown and sip cappuccino at a sidewalk cafe. Catch fresh fish for dinner. Even tour a working winery. Just minutes from all the rest Florida has to offer. Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Plan your visit online at BradentonGulfIslands.com. That's BradentonGulfIslands.com.
The beauty of Amlinks Interior Landscape is that We can come in, work with your budget, and create a fit that makes sense for your facility at that time. Our goal is to create foliage designs that not only look incredible the day we put them in, but you can go back 2 years later and it is still maintained and has grown as a perfect fit for that customer's environment.
Call Amlings now at 888-880-TREE.
If you look hard enough, go off the beaten track far enough, you'll find an America teeming with the unusual, the odd, the downright strange.
I'm Will Klinger, and I'm your guide on a package tour we like to call
Wild Travels.
Join me for a new season of Wild Travels, Sundays at 10:30 p.m. on WTTW Channel 11.
My name is Johnny Carson. My job is to make you laugh.
Johnny Carson brings you TV legends and classic moments every night.
Don't make fun of me, Johnny.
And now through October, don't miss Here's Johnny, the making of The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. It's a must-see collection of Johnny's stage props, costumes, video, and more. For more info and tickets, go to museum.tv.
A historic moment from the archives at museum.tv.
I did not have sexual relations with that woman, Miss Lewinsky. I never told anybody to lie, not a single time, never. These allegations are false, and I need to go back to work for the American people. Thank you.
Experience more history at museum.tv.
Back to Beyond the Beltway. I'm Bruno Behrendt. I'm actually normally, if you've seen me on this show, I'm on the other side of the microphone where I'm giving my opinion as a guest. But today I'm actually guest hosting because Bruce is taken off to Palm Springs to be with family for what looks to be a blessed event in the family. So that's where Bruce is today. And I'm filling in for him with my excellent panel of guests tonight. So what we're going to do here in this segment, maybe the next few segments, we've talked about Trump. We've talked, you know, we got General Mattis, we've got the Ohio speech, we've got various different things, but we're going to let you, the caller, and incidentally, if you need to call, it's 1-800-723-8289 to call into the show. We're going to take a call in just a moment, but we're going to kind of try and solve America's problems. We got a new president. He needs our help. Maybe he doesn't need as much help as maybe you think. He's fantastic. He's got all the help from all his billionaire friends that he's going to get. But we're going to try to give him some help tonight and come up with solutions. I'm going to ask all of the guests what they think Trump should do or what they think the most important place for him to start will be. But first, we're going to go to Eve in Detroit, who has a comment regarding what we were talking about in the past on Medicaid and insurance. Eve, go ahead. You're on the air.
Much for taking my call. It's just, if we don't somehow put in more restrictions for pharmaceutical companies raising medicine however they please, I find it really hard to protect programs like Medicare or Obamacare or anything like that to ensure that healthcare premiums won't go up.
And you're basically talking about the price of pharmaceuticals, where some company can come in, buy a company that owns a specific product that no one's really competing with, and then just jacking the price up. Is that, you know, the primary concern that you're talking about?
Yes. In the last 2 months, an EpiPen has gone up $200. How would you not expect that healthcare premiums won't go up along with those charges?
I tend to agree with you, at least on the economics. I don't know specifically what the solution is. Brian, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, the pharmaceutical market isn't really a free market. I mean, there's so many controls on it, and I don't really have the answer either. I'm not an expert in pharmaceuticals, but I definitely know that that is not a good practice to have someone come in and jack up the prices. We don't want controls. I think we need to find some other solution.
So a liberal or a liberal Democrat would say, well, the solution is that it's just not regulated enough and we don't have enough controls on this. Ray, your thoughts?
That would have been
for Eve.
That would have been my thought, that we go in and regulate the insurance industry. I thought Obamacare was going to do that to an extent, and what it didn't do, and I'm not sure if it was because of all the business interests in Congress, but it didn't cap the dramatically rising premium costs. My friends have been complaining about how their premiums have doubled over the last couple of years. That's not good. Donut hole for prescription drugs, for Medicare and for seniors, those are big problems that no one's really addressed. Instead, we've kind of focused on, I think, the easy end of the healthcare industry and not the one that we should be addressing.
Tio.
Okay,
go ahead, Eve.
Well, and also re-aging Medicare itself, you're relying on the oldest of people, which is also the more expensive end of who you're insuring. So if you are allowing younger ages to use Medicare, you might get healthier people, and those costs may go down to ensure the longevity of Medicare itself.
Well, it's an interesting point, but I think what you have to do first, I mean, that's similar. The idea behind Obamacare is to have this mandate that everybody had to have health insurance. And if you look at what the young are doing, they're kind of just saying, I'll take the penalty instead of going in. Tio?
Well, my thing is, when I ran for governor, I made it clear one of my platform issues, we talked about people that have terminal illness should not have to pay for any type of medication, period. That's something that we should make sacred, all right? And then if people are on a medium level of having an illness and they can't afford the medicine, there should be an automatic reduction in the cost, like a 50% reduction. This is something that I hope Donald Trump will take a look at and maybe push this, you know, during his time as president anyway. I would like to see something like that happen.
Who's supposed to develop all these new drugs? Are you going to take out your time, Bruno, and with no compensation and spend millions of your own dollars to take a chance that you might find a drug that might just work, and when it finally comes out, we're going to let you have a dollar a pill instead of maybe the $25 a pill you need to make a go of it, to make it worth it.
It's a humane thing to do. That's what I'm talking about. It's
but
humane.
Your desire for humanity is trying to undo.
There should be a government subsidy.
No.
That's the kind of argument that's upsetting, though, because to the food industry and say that, you know, let's just have one company making bread and let's charge $500 for a loaf of bread people starve.
See what you started here? Are you still with us?
We started a riot on the show.
But if what you want are cheap drugs, we can make that happen.
But what
if you want are the best drugs available and new drugs that do new things? The best way to make sure that doesn't happen is to control the price of drugs.
Okay, so Eve, it was a really good question. I think you have put two different things on there. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to use your call, and thank you very much for the call, by the way. And listen in. Go ahead. Do you have a last word?
No, I was just saying thank you for taking my call, but I feel like talking about what Obamacare, these other things, are almost like a distraction tactic from talking about more regulations on pharmaceutical companies.
Well, it's an excellent point, and thank you very much for your call. So what I'm going to do here for a moment, let's see if we can do this. We'll try and use this as an object lesson to throwing out solutions. And maybe the solutions don't work, but, you know, we asked I think Americans ask a valid question when somebody comes in, buys a company that has one drug, jacks the price 200%, and then normally, the way things would work in America, what happens is if somebody goes, oh, the price just got jacked up 200%, I'm going to get into that market. But then there's patent law and there's all kinds of other things that come in there. So I'm just going to throw out a solution. And I will say, Mike, I'm more with you on this and the points that you were raising, because you can't just take the last remaining nation that innovates in drugs and is coming up with all kinds of drugs and shut it down. But one of the thoughts that I've had, and you guys all jump in here, callers jump in too. We've got some calls coming in. And if you want to call, it's 800-723-8289. But I'm just going to throw this out. Why not extend eminent domain to drugs? And if you've got a blockbuster drug that can cure diabetes, let's say, or do something really big, clearly the company needs its compensation. It should get compensation. You want companies to be able to go out and innovate and do things. But the government just comes in and says, you know what? That's a really good drug. We're going to negotiate and set a price. And because we have a legitimate public need of citizens who need access to drugs that can save their lives, we're going to do eminent domain on your patent. We're going to buy it from you. You're going to make a profit. You're going to get what you want. But after you make your profit, you can go on to develop new drugs, but we're going to do that. So, Mike, you're looking at me so skeptically right now that I'm some kind of dangerous communist. Go ahead.
One thing you were saying, you know, what could we hope that Trump will do? And part of it to me would be to live in a world where we have a limited government with enumerated powers. And certainly the idea of eminent domain is one of those. But it has nothing to do with drugs. It has to do with building a school or building a road.
And if
the government can force you to sell, what is mine anymore? I have nothing that is mine anymore. So I develop a book, and everybody should read this book. So I'm going to take this book from you. I'll offer you what I say is a good price.
All right. So we've got that on the table. We've got some people that look like they're chomping at the bit. So when we come back, we'll have some people answer that question for me, and then we'll go to callers right after that. Back after this.
Coco and Joe, Susie Snowflake, Frosty the Snowman, and now Peter Cottontail have been digitally remastered by the Museum of Broadcast Communications. To own your digitally remastered DVD, go to museum.tv. All proceeds benefit the museum.
My name is Johnny Carson. My job is to make you laugh.
Johnny Carson brings you TV legends and classic moments every night on Antenna TV.
Don't make fun of me, Johnny.
And now through October, don't miss Here's Johnny, the making of The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. It's a must-see collection of Johnny's stage props, costumes, video, and more. For more info and tickets, go to museum.tv.
Welcome back to Beyond the Beltway. My name is Bruno Barron. I'm filling in for Bruce Dumont today. And if you're just joining us, we are kind of throwing the show open to your ideas, to the panelists' ideas. I'll give you an example I just threw out on the table regarding to Eve asked a very good question. She was one of our callers. And she said, well, what do we do about drug prices and people buying up these companies and jacking the price up? To which I said, why don't we just have eminent domain for drugs? That generated a little bit of discussion. If you've got some similar kind of idea, you want to call in at 800-723-8289 for, you know, give Donald Trump, not just me, not just our panel, not Beyond the Beltway, but give Donald Trump your best out-of-the-box idea for America. But in the meantime, Tio, so what did you think about the eminent domain thing, just to take that a few seconds forward?
I think it's a good idea as far as the drug companies make it eminent domain because, like, for example, when we took a break, I said, let's say if a person has autism, and there's a pill that can cure autism, but the family doesn't have the money to purchase the pill. The government should be able to step up then. And once you make it eminent domain, the government can get involved in it. I mean, I think that'll be a great thing because if you can make it more even playing field, why would you withhold a miracle drug like that from a person that can be 100% healthy?
Okay.
So that's what we have to begin to think like. And I understand the pharmaceutical companies need to make money. I got that. But the government should be involved on a higher level to make sure that everybody has equal access.
If you want one word to explain my reticence about your position, the word is kilo.
Okay.
Do you know that case?
Yes, I do know the kilo. I'm a lawyer too, by the way.
Yeah,
but
so
I do know the kilo case. So we've got one vote against, one vote for on my crazy idea. Ray, go ahead.
I think your idea sounds good. I'm willing to try almost anything. My idea would be to reimplement the draft, require everybody to serve at least 2 years in the military when they're young, either when they're in college or after they get out of college. I think it, and preferably maybe even before they're in college, it did me a lot of good. I served 2 years during the Vietnam War, 10 years in the Illinois Air National Guard, and it really it set my compass. It really got my head together, and I was able to kind of change my whole life because of that.
Okay.
And it also provided work. It provided a job, and I saw street gang members come into the military and come out soldiers, and I think that you know, I don't know if there's one answer to solve our problems, but if I wanted to see something, that would be the program I would do.
Well, my dad was a big fan of the draft, and he said that he basically for the exact same reason that you were talking about. So, Brian, your thoughts on the idea, and also if you want to throw out your own idea.
Well, the eminent domain idea implies someone's eminent, and if that's government trying to decide when the drug is ripe and what we're going to pay them, I don't trust the government. That's what the Donald Trump election's all about. So many people just decided, hey, we're
Donald
sick of
it. Donald Trump might like the eminent domain idea.
Well, he might. But a lot of people are sick of it believe me.
Okay.
And that's why Brexit happened and Bernie Sanders, and a lot of people are revolting against power. So I'm not sure that idea would really work. But the idea that we want to make sure that people get the right drugs is a good idea.
Exactly.
No doubt about it. We just have to look at it more closely and come up with a way that makes sure we continue to develop drugs and also get people the right drugs.
And think about this.
It's not going to be an easy solution.
Irvin Magic Johnson had HIV.
Right.
But the report out now that he's much better. There's no trace of HIV in his system.
Right.
Because he had the money to buy the high-level drugs. But what if other people had the money to buy those high-level drugs, or there was kind of some kind of supplement? That would be major, because now people are not out there spreading HIV.
Right. We're also at the situation where there's only so much money to go around. Unless we are actually going to be able to print money forever and live in an inflation-free, low-interest-rate environment forever and ever, amen, which I don't think we can do. We've got some callers that might have some ideas here. We've got Brian and Roselle here in Chicago listening to us streaming on Sirius. Military spending. Go ahead, Brian.
Yeah, our Pentagon spending is about nearly a third of our budget. And in my opinion, the entire world has been freeloading on the security that we provide the planet, the Western world, the free markets, securing the oil supplies for the entire world by butting up with Saudi Arabia, patrolling the Persian Gulf and whatnot. And I think we need to have the world contribute, instead of just the American taxpayer shouldering the burden. I think we should put a tariff on every item that's imported in the United States, say 10%, to pay the Pentagon budget. And then I would also put a 10% gas tax on our fuel, so Americans would realize that one of the big reasons we have cheap, plentiful fuel is because we spend hundreds of billions of dollars on the military protecting our oil supplies all over the world. It's not just domestic production. I've heard that story. It's a global market. The Saudis are flooding the oil market right now. That's why gas is so cheap. You know, if you took the Saudi oil and the Iranian and the Iraqi oil off the market, our gas prices would be back up to $4 a gallon or higher. So military spending has a huge influence on the world economy, and I think the world needs to help pay for it.
All right. Well, let's take that to the panel out there. Ray, you first.
Well, I have to say I write for the Arab News in Saudi Arabia, so I'm not anti-Saudi. But I will say that that's a positive. I mean, the Saudis have been our closest allies. They manipulate the cost of oil so that it keeps our prices down. You go to Europe, you pay $20 a gallon for gasoline. We're worried about paying $4, and we're paying $2.50. You know, when you read Trump's book, Great America, he talks about just, you know, doing that we should make these countries pay us for what we do to help them. Instead of us giving money to other foreign countries, if we're going to support them or defend them, they should pay us. And they should fund our military in a way. We shouldn't be dependent on them, but they should make Iraq should make some kind of contribution to us. But it didn't work properly, but that's the concept.
Tio, we're going to send Germany a bill. Invoice them. You know, so this is your yearly invoice for our protection umbrella. Is Angela Merkel going to pay it? Are the German taxpayers going to pay it?
The German taxpayers should pay that cost. My son is in the National Guard right now. He's 18 years old. So I believe in a strong military myself. So, yeah, I think the country should pay if they're getting protection, without a doubt. And I believe Donald Trump, being an absolute businessman, he's going to probably take a look at that. That's a good idea from Mr. Brian there.
Well, and I'm sure that, Mike, you're gonna probably throw water all over the gas tax idea.
I am, yeah. But I do like the idea of having the others pay for the support we give them. Nothing fries me more than to hear people say that the United States spends as much on military as the rest of the world combined. And that is because we take care of the rest of the world, for heaven's sake. That's why Japan doesn't have to have as big a military, or Germany, or Czech Republic, or even England and France and so forth, because we're the big guy. We're the ones that will take care of them. I absolutely agree with you, but I don't – then we broke lines as soon as you start going into energy. I'm not convinced that the energy prices don't already reflect the fact that the U.S. protects them. Also, I don't see why – why is it wonderful that the Europeans pay $10, $12, $15 for a gallon of gas.
It's not wonderful.
It's terrible.
It is.
I don't understand.
But that's the reality. They're paying it. We're not.
I also – see, he's got me going now. You know, people say, oh, the United States –
that Mike got going.
We're the United States, we're addicted to oil, and we keep bringing it in from outside the country. Do you know how much oil Japan has to import?
All of it.
100%. And somehow they're not addicted to oil. I just think the whole oil market is there's so much emotion. You can hear it in me. It's that it's driven by nonsense.
Why not let the price of gasoline go to what it should be in the market the way we do it with drugs?
We do.
Let a gallon of gas cost $10 a gallon.
It wouldn't cost that much.
You don't think so? Why is it so much someplace else?
Because they tax it.
Brian, we're going to come back to you in just a second to get your view on what the panel has said here. But first we're going to go to Brian, our panelist. What are your thoughts on that? So $4, you know, just raise gas taxes, get them up there and make Americans pay.
Well, there's an argument. That was an Al Gore argument, right, that we'll raise a big gas tax and we'll be able to fund our roads and bridges and things like that. You know, there's something to be said to maybe doing something like that. We do need to find a way to pay for all the things that we're not paying for right now. Now, clearly, other countries around the world are not paying us for all the things we're doing for them, but I don't think it'll ever be that way.
No,
we're the leader of the world, and that's how it is. So we just have to find some happy medium.
Well, and speaking of happy mediums, so, Brian, you've heard the panelists here critique your idea. Are you ready to write it up and send it to the Trump transition team?
Yeah, I'd like to just expand a little bit. Let's talk about China all by itself, the Chinese. You know, we know that they engage in industrial espionage. They're ripping us off. They're engaging in all kinds of hijinks, North Korea, what's going on in the South China Sea. And then we, honestly, in the next decade, we're going to spend hundreds of billions of dollars defending against the Chinese, just the Chinese. If you throw in security costs, cyber warfare, and everything else, hundreds of billions of dollars defending against China, our frenemy. You got to remember the term frenemy. Like the Saudis are our frenemy. Now, we're going to spend all this money against China to defend against the Chinese, but yet we let our American businesses just run over to China, set up shop, and bring their products back to the United States, you know, duty free. It's idiotic. If you have to do business with China, you're going to pay for it. You know, or you could always set up your factory in the United States, or you could set up your factory in a country that's more friendly to the United States.
And Brian, I'm going to guess that Brian, if you can hear me, you weren't upset with Trump taking that call from Taiwan, right?
No.
Good. I wasn't either. I agree with you.
Things up. We need to shake up the order.
But it's much less likely we will go to war with China if we trade with China than if we don't trade with China.
Brian just wanted to
going to pay for it.
We're going to have to go out just a little bit. I just want to thank you for your phone call. You've really put in a really good bunch of ideas there, and I really do think we all need to start thinking about this kind of stuff. But thank you very much for the call. I think he's making a very, very good point about all of the different things, but it isn't so easy to just break the paradigm on all of these things. So one of the things I'm going to do, next question I'm going to ask all of you, since we're kind of rolling here, and we do have calls. We're going to get to Saul right after the break and talk to you about your idea. But what if we did something where we swapped taxes, not raised taxes, but swapped them, a little bit less income tax, a little bit more consumption tax, something like that. So those are the kind of ideas we want you to throw on the table here at 1-800-723-8289 for the rest of the show.
Okay.
Back after this.
If you look hard enough, go off the beaten track far enough, you'll find an America teeming with the unusual, the odd, the downright strange.
I'm Will Klinger, and I'm your guide on a package tour we like to call
Wild Travels.
Join me for a new season of Wild Travels, Sundays at 10:30 p.m. on WTTW Channel 11.
The Museum of Broadcast Communications is Chicago's perfect place for senior citizens. Enjoy a stroll down memory lane. Reminisce as museum artifacts, photos, and classic TV shows trigger recollections from your childhood. Enjoy the TLC you'll receive from our expert tour guides. Discounts for groups of 20 or more. Schedule yours right now at museum.tv or call 312-245-8200. Plan your fun trip now at the Museum of Broadcast Communications.
Welcome back, America. I'm Bruno Barron. I'm sitting in for Bruce today. So if you're wondering why you're tuning in and seeing a different face, or if you're just tuning in right now, Bruce is out in Palm Springs, and hopefully he's going to be witnessing the birth of a grandchild soon. So that's he called me up, and he said, "Hey, Bruno, you've been a guest on the show. Can you guest host for me?" And I said, "Absolutely." So hopefully I'm doing okay. But what we've done here a little bit is we're throwing out ideas. So it's 800-723-8289. We're coming up with interesting ideas, wild ideas, out-of-the-box ideas. We've had some callers come in and suggest some really good stuff, as well as starting a really good part of the program in talking about their ideas. So we're throwing stuff out there. First, we're going to go to Saul in New York, who has a price control idea, which I'm sure Mike is going to really enjoy. Saul, go ahead.
Yes, I'm not for price controls, but since we live in an imperfect world where a great part of the developed world actually does have price controls, maybe we can use that to our advantage and tell the drug companies, you know, we don't have price controls in the United States, but you have to sell it here for the lowest price you're selling it anywhere in the developed world.
So anybody want to jump in on that?
Brian? I like it.
You sell it to at the same price with the developed world?
No, I think right. I think the price should be the price the market will bear wherever it is. I don't.
No, but his point is sell it less here than what you're selling it for in foreign countries.
Well, go ahead.
The price depends upon the ability of people to buy and the importance that they put on something.
I think they're pricing the price it because they know we can pay for it.
Well, but see, then you're magically trying to control or manipulate prices, and people are just very bad at that.
So let me just jump in on
that. We're giving the market some kind of infinite powers. The mechanism of the market works when supply can meet demand. When you're talking about a patented item, you're talking about a government-granted monopoly, which may be a wise idea, but it is an exception to the way the market typically works.
I think you're making a very good point, and I'll just add to that point. And Saul, thank you very much for your idea. You've raised an excellent point here. I think what's fair to say is that Americans don't pay a market price for the drugs. What Saul is alluding to, and it's not necessarily for every drug, for everything that goes on, but Germany, Canada, everybody goes to the drug companies and they negotiate a much lower per pill price because their national system. So we live under this myth that Canada is a single buyer. Germany is a single buyer. They negotiate Viagra prices. They negotiate prices for all the drugs. And then it turns around, and guess who's left? So they get this really low negotiated price, and guess who's left holding the bag for the artificially increased price so that the pharmaceutical companies can make most of their investment back? Mm-hmm. Mike, you're the—
I agree. You're absolutely correct that this is what happens. But again, if we cannot make enough money to justify the investment, we won't invest in new drugs. If you want to go with all the drugs we have up till now, they'll eventually all become generic and they'll all be really cheap, but there will be no new inventions that will save our lives.
I disagree with that. I think that our system and our lifestyle and our economy is so much different that if all these wealthy, because the pharmaceutical companies are people I don't like, when you put them on a scale, they're at the top of the list of people that I dislike. And I think if they said, you know what, nah, we're going to take our marbles and leave, I think other people will step up to the plate and will develop the drugs and we will actually see a market. And they will come back because they can't lose – they don't want to lose their profits.
Okay. Well, then how about you and the other three here that maybe don't – if they agree with you, why don't you do it?
Great.
Take all of your retirement money and put it into a firm and go ahead and do it.
But I bet there is somebody out there who would do that. And I bet that if there was a vacuum, it would happen.
Yeah, it's always somebody else.
Well, we have a very vibrant startup community here in Chicago located just a few blocks from where we are today, and a lot of the folks that do develop drugs and develop new business of any kind, including drugs, are very entrepreneurial. So it is possible that they're going to go out and try to develop drugs, even if maybe the economics aren't as good as they were before. Mm. But at the same time, price controls are generally a bad idea.
My roommate was the best drug maker at Northern Illinois.
You're well, talking about
on
those.
That note, in the 1970s. So
okay. That Northern. Yeah,
Cut to Tio really quickly.
I'm just going to keep it simple. If a person invents a drug, they get a patent on it, they turn it over to the United States, and they get paid for the rest of their lives and their children's lives and generations to come for their invention. Mm-hmm. That's what I think should happen. Therefore, the United States government can regulate the prices of the drugs, and everybody will have an opportunity to be healthy in society. Well, it's the best humane thing to do.
And I think Mike would maybe say, go for it and see if it actually works out that way. Let's go to Dirk in Springfield, Illinois on WMAY. He wants to change the tax structure. Dirk, you're on the air.
Yeah, I'd like to change the corporate tax to taxing corporations like they were partnerships. So all the income is taxed to the owners the year they make it. So right now, large corporations get a hoard cash to buy other companies. Versus, you know, all politicians always like to run around and say they love small businesses, but small businessmen have to pay taxes on their income every year.
Right, and they get to do that. The large number of them, the vast majority of them here in the United States, do that through subchapter S, where they essentially pass all their profits through. You're saying essentially allow C corporations, the big corporations, to do it the same way and not have retained earnings or dividend or something like that. Mike, what are your thoughts on that?
I guess it's worth it if you can show me that this would be, say, revenue neutral or something. I might be willing to do it, but we almost have to keep in mind something that Milton Friedman once said, and that is that corporations don't actually pay taxes. They remit taxes. They send taxes into the government. So when I go to Jimmy John's and get a sandwich, buried in the price of that sandwich is the price of the electricity, the price of the worker, but also the price of the income tax that they have to pay on the money that they make. So the idea that Jimmy John's pays taxes is not right. I pay it for it in the price of the item that I buy. So this idea that Trump has to lower the income tax on corporations, I like the idea. But the problem is then there has to be a way that we capture that much money. We need that much money to run the government. There needs to be another way that the taxes are taken care of. And maybe a consumption tax would be the way to go, or that all the taxes are paid by those who receive dividends, and the dividends would be charged at the same price and or same tax rate. And
Brian,
the issue
with
the corporate taxes is that our corporate taxes are the highest in the world.
Right.
So that's just really a competitive issue, right? So
yeah.
So how do we get companies want to locate here and not leave America and inversions?
That's
and
what's inversion
like
that. Is,
so
right?
So, Dirk,
right.
You wanted to jump in here quickly?
If you're eliminating the corporate tax, you don't have those companies wanting to leave the country.
So
you have companies wanting to do business here.
But your idea is essentially to say, have the money passed through to the owners of the corporation, which is basically saying you have to pay out dividends in the year that they're earned.
Yep.
You would probably have like some kind of a retained earnings tax so that they don't retain earnings, or if they do, they pay a tax on it. Maybe a corporation wants to save money to buy a piece of property or something like that. But is that essentially your idea that you're putting out there?
Yeah, it's basically treating large corporations the same way you treat small businessmen.
Them expense the entire purchase of capital in that same year, or would you allow them to spread it over many years? So in other words, they buy a very large machine and they would depreciate it over 10 years. If they would expense it all in 1 year, that would lower their net taxes. So if you're going to make them declare all income in that same year, are you going to make them declare all expenses in that same year?
I would amortize capital over the life of the equipment, except for in times when I think that we need to actually accelerate depreciation to stimulate the economy.
Okay. And we want to make sure this doesn't devolve into beyond the accounting beltway.
Yeah, we're getting into a real heavy
Dirk,
gap here.
Thank you very much for that. And, all of this will be on the test. You will all have to learn about expensing and capitalization and amortization of capital equipment. We've got Tom in Wisconsin Dells. He actually sounds like Tom, it looks like you'd agree with some of the ideas we just talked about here. Go ahead.
Yeah. Obviously, the simplest, very inexpensive way to fix all this is a fair tax, not a flat tax, fair tax. Everybody pays taxes. Then you buy something, you pay tax. $50,000.
You're breaking up a little bit. I think you're. Are you on a bad cell? I think you're breaking up.
He's gone.
Yeah, he's gone. Tom, sorry about that. I think so. Tom's position, it was at least it looked up on the screen there. It was basically the fair tax, the national sales tax idea. Tio?
Well, this is where the problem is coming in at. You have a lot of elected officials that are taxing the poor and working class people because they are mismanaging the tax money that we already have on the books. That's what's happening here in Illinois. They're robbing Peter to pay Paul. And on a national level, it happens in a lot of different states as well. We have to stop thinking about more taxes and just be a little bit more prudent as we manage what we have. That's where a big problem is coming.
Sounding like a Republican on the panel.
Well, you know, I might be.
we should look at perhaps a national sales tax, but it shouldn't be in addition to all the other taxes
right.
we have.
Right,
now.
Exactly.
So, you know, if we want to change value added taxes, national sales, you know, all that could be on the table. You know, we talked about flat taxes with Steve Forbes in '96. I mean, so anything can be on the table, but it shouldn't be finding new ways to confiscate more of the public's money. It is the public's money, not the government's money.
I'm paying 10% in Orland Park on sales taxes.
Wow. That's
I don't
crazy.
Need
I
another percent on top of that. But what I would like to see is government all take 1 or 2% across the board rather than each individual government imposing their own tax and then put a national sales tax across the country. And do something like that. I'd rather see
and
that.
And here we are in the process of solving all America's problems. And this is Beyond the Beltway. My name is Bruno Behrend. I've been sitting in here for Bruce Dumont today, and I really do appreciate it. I want to give thanks to Ray Hanania, Brian Castle, Mike Miller, and T.O. Hardiman for coming on this Sunday. It's been a real pleasure having you on. And, you know, good luck to Bruce for going out and having the time to spend some time with family, as his daughter's expecting. So we'll be back on Beyond the Beltway later on.
All right.
Of Amlinks Interior Landscape is that we can come in, work with your budget, and create a fit that makes sense for your facility at that time. Our goal is to create foliage designs that not only look incredible the day we put them in, but you can go back 2 years later and it is still maintained and has grown as a perfect fit for that customer's environment.
Call Amlings now at 888-880-TREE.
A historic moment from the archives at museum.tv.
There can be no stable and enduring peace without the participation of the People's Republic of China and its 750 million people. That is why I have undertaken initiatives in several areas to open the door for more normal relations between our two countries.
Experience more history at museum.tv.
Welcome back, everybody. Here we are on Beyond the Beltway. My name is Bruno Behrend. I'm sitting in for Bruce Dumont. And if you recognize my voice, you probably recognize me as somebody who's been a guest on the show. And I was just sitting in today for Bruce. He called me up and asked me to sit in for him. It's been a real pleasure. I've really been enjoying it. We've got T.O. Hardiman here, Ray Hanania, Brian Cassell, and Mike Miller. We're having a fantastic discussion, 800-723-8289. We're coming up with ideas for the Trump administration to make the world a better place and to give this new president all the really cool ideas he could possibly have. We had some great calls regarding some of those ideas. I know that Mike didn't particularly like the price control ones, but you haven't thrown out your idea yet.
Oh, I have. I've been arguing this for a long time, and I thought my liberal friends would really love it. But here's my deal. Don't start Social Security taxes on your income until you hit some number, say $40,000 or $50,000. But every dollar that you make, it counts towards your Social Security in your your retirement, if that makes sense, because you have to have so many quarters
right.
to get covered. But what you have to do then is you have to raise the income limit until you make just as much money as we were making before. So you simply take the tax and you shift it from zero to $120,000 to, say, $50,000 to $200,000. But all of us don't pay anything on the first $50,000. And then after that, we all pay until we hit how much money we would normally take in under Social Security. This way, it reduces the tax on a new employee who is average income. It reduces their tax by 14.5%.
And that goes to both the employer
and the employee. And if you think about it, really, Social Security is a fringe benefit of the employee because the employer doesn't pay it unless you're hired.
Right.
So really, the worker is on the hook for the whole thing, the whole 14.5%.
Right. It's still a cost of employment.
And I'm simply removing that, and I'm giving them credit, so they won't lose out on their Social Security benefits. And it then takes it and it shifts the tax to those who make over the median income. And you, like I say, you break it, say at $200,000, wherever it takes to make the amount of money generated the same. This lowers the cost to employers to hire these new people, to hire these low-income people. And it also gives these people 7.5% more income that they take home that they can spend on goods and services. I just think it's ingenious, but nobody – I've argued this several years, and nobody wants to –
Okay, vote at the table. Is this idea ingenious? I mean, actually, it sounds really good to me. I mean, Tio, you're basically lowering the cost of the low-income worker on one end. You're getting the money back on the other end, making the cost of employment, the cost of entry-level employment lower. What's not to like?
I think it's a win-win situation for the entire country.
I like it.
Everybody. I like it.
Good okay. Idea. We got Ray. You're the only holdout here.
I'm not an economist. I think it sounds in theory okay. How would that impact somebody who's just starting? Maybe they'd take more money home then,
No, they do. That's the whole point.
Exactly. Take more money.
Yes.
Yeah. The business wouldn't have to
it wouldn't have
pay
to match,
match anything
right.
at that level.
Now, that would create – there will come this
and
one
they'd
point.
And they still get a Social Security credit.
That's the point. They have okay. to still get the credit. Now, it does create that one point where all of a sudden, if you make $1 more, now you're in the system.
Right.
They'd have to work that out somehow. That would be a problem.
And that's going to happen no matter what.
That's going to happen no matter what.
I think
what.
We chalk that one up to somebody here is responsible for writing the memo and sending it to the Trump administration. Brian, your idea?
I was just going to comment that it almost seems like that's what we've done with income taxes, where,
oh, sure.
where people making up to a certain level really don't pay because
about,
of all the credits.
Yeah, I think people making under $50,000 pay about 4% of the total income tax. Now, they pay their Social Security and sales taxes and excise taxes.
Right.
But when it comes to the income tax per se, that people making $50,000 or below pay 4% of the total amount of taxes.
Right.
And so we've already done this. We can
okay.
do it again.
So
we can shift it.
It shows
to the right.
that it works. Tio, you're when you were talking about what you're doing, you're actually very concerned. And Mike has mentioned this, and you've mentioned this. There's some social components to these problems that yeah. all the tax policy, all the brilliant economic ideas in the world, all the Chinese telephone calls to Taiwan and all this stuff to have no impact on. So how do you solve some of these big social problems for the disadvantaged?
Well, what I'm really concerned about right now is the high levels of violence here in Chicago and across the United States. But right now, Chicago leads. I'm not going to say Chicago leads the nation per 100,000 people, but we have 700 homicides to date, 4,000 people shot in Chicago to date. And we have to work harder in the area of preventing these shootings and killings on the front end. This is the home of President Barack Obama. You got Minister Louis Farrakhan lives in Chicago. Jesse mm-hmm. Jackson Sr. lives in Chicago. Some of the strongest leaders, the brilliant minds are here. There's no way in the world we should not be able to get a handle on this. There's no program that's going to really stop the killing. I think it's incumbent upon African-American men to step up to the plate
that's
and work
key.
Things out in their community because everybody keeps saying, I need money, I need a program. I know people need to work, but a lot of the violence is not really about a person not having a job.
So what can we do to help that?
Well, what you can do is the African-American leaders, once again, have got to assemble a great team of brilliant minds and work with the young guys out on them streets out there and get them to put their guns down and then help them become productive members of society. Because we have more of a thinking problem than we also have like a serious violence problem because the thoughts are in your mind already. That's where the problem is coming in at. And the reason I say African-American because over 85% of the killings occur in the African-American community.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
That's why I say that. The police can't stop killings. Let me tell you why. And I'm not anti-police. I want to make that clear. The police have been in response mode for over 100 years, which dictates waiting for you to cross
right.
the line and commit a crime, then they get involved.
So
that's the only reason they can't stop it.
Does the police situation here in Chicago, is that at least part of the problem with the numbers that we're seeing?
It's part of the problem, but you got to think about over the last two or three decades, you still had high levels of gun violence in Chicago. So it's not because the people rising up against the police. It's because the police haven't been trained to stop it before it happens.
Okay.
So what's great about that is I'm glad you said that, but the problem is I can't say that. Because
exactly.
I'm white.
Right.
And I would be called a racist if I were to say
so Ray,
exactly what you just
Ray,
said.
You're
I was going to ask how, Tio, if you could tell us how that connects to the pathetic level of education we get in Chicago, a system that when you look at what we produce, and we've got great kids going into the system, they just don't come out at the level that they used to. And I'm wondering, does that feed into the violence? And is that a national problem? Can we address education in a way that would impact this violence that isn't just in Chicago?
And Ray, on that note, I'm going to have to cut you off, and we're going to have to spend the next week's show addressing that issue because we're running out of time. But my thanks to Ray Hanania again, Brian Casale, Mike Miller, and T.O. Hardiman. And I'd also like to thank Colin Bobbitt, Fritz Goldman, and Dan Dorfman for their assistance in getting this program on the air and helping me make it through my first guest host run. I'm Bruno Barron, substituting for Bruce Dumont. This is Beyond the Beltway, and it is a Genevieve production. Good night.
Everyone loves vacationing in Florida, so why not experience it as it was meant to be? Where turquoise Gulf waters meet tranquil island beaches. Feel the powder-soft sand between your toes. Revel in a glorious island sunset. Shop the boutiques of a seaside village. Ride horseback along tranquil waters. This is Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Real, authentic Florida, where you can discover an intimate downtown and sip cappuccino at a sidewalk cafe. Catch fresh fish for dinner. Even tour a working winery. Just minutes from all the rest Florida has to offer. Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Plan your visit online at BradentonGulfIslands.com. That's BradentonGulfIslands.com.
The beauty of Amling's interior landscape is that we can come in, work with your budget, and create a fit that makes sense for your facility at that time. Our goal is to create foliage designs that not only look incredible the day we put them in, but you can go back 2 years later and it is still maintained and has grown as a perfect fit for that customer's environment.
Call Amlings now at 888-880-TREE.
If you look hard enough, go off the beaten track far enough, you'll find an America teeming with the unusual, the odd, the downright strange.
I'm Will Klinger, and I'm your guide on a package tour we like to call
Wild Travels.
Join me for a new season of Wild Travels, Sundays at 10:30 p.m. on WTTW Channel 11.